All right, welcome to Escape from Plan A for this week. I've got my, I'm going to call you Meow Meow because I say Mike. There's another Mike that cops on the podcast a lot, but
yeah, it's fine. Meow Meow is fine. That's my Twitter handle, by the way.
Uh-oh, I heard that. That sounds like a bottle of scotch.
It's actually Armenian cognac.
Armenian cognac.
Well,
you told me about
that. Well, technically, it's not it's Armenian brandy.
Yeah.
But during the time of the Soviet Union, they didn't care about trademark because, you know, cognacs can only come from France, right?
Yeah. Region.
Cognac, so they didn't care, so they called it Armenian cognac. This is
interesting.
You know, so I like it because it tastes like, you know, good brandy or cognac, but it's like a third of the price.
All right, get that medicine in you.
Yeah.
But you were asking how the New Year's been, and I said it's been an incredibly exciting 24 days.
Yeah.
I have to say. This is an incredible year.
It's like, you know, first they release, you know, the Chinese release stealth fighters. Was it the sixth gen? That was around the holidays, right? And then, there was the Red Note stuff that exploded. And then now the DeepSeek stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like,
yeah, it's been a chain of things. And this stretches way back. I mean, it was the Mate 20 before that. And it was the space station and the Rabbit Rover and all this stuff. I mean, it was just like, a lot of stuff. I mean, you're only talking about China.
I'm only talking about China because you know, my family's there, and you know, it was a research interest of mine when I was in grad school. So
Xiaohongshu is an incredible. It's a truly incredible thing. A lot of people that I was talking to had analogized it to the digital Berlin Wall coming down. And I thought, it's funny. That's a funny comparison. People did not mean it literally, of course.
Yeah.
But I will say there's something about that comparison that I think is apt, don't you think? There's some iron curtain that was breached here.
Well, it seems funny because it's not so much like the iron curtain didn't collapse. Like the wall is still there, right? But it's like Americans actively choosing. So it's like, you know, you build, technically speaking, you build the Iron Curtain to prevent the Chinese from accessing the outside world. And that, or, you know, the East Berliners from going to the West. But then all of a sudden, but they're not really prepared for the other direction of the traffic.
Right.
All of a sudden, you're getting Americans going across the Iron Curtain.
Across,
like, yeah, fuck it. You know, I don't care about the censorship. Mm-hmm. Going right across. And then, you know, going straight into China.
Yeah.
So it's like, you know, who knew? Like, it becomes ineffective in the sense that, or not that it's not ineffective. I mean, there's still technically, I mean, there's still censorship. But, you know, who knew that Americans would be like, fuck it. Yeah, we'll take the Great Firewall. No big deal. Yeah. So, yeah. And then there was actually a headline from, I just saw on a tweet, and it's pretty funny. I'll read it out loud if you like. It's someone wrote, I think it's for Tablet Magazine, I don't know. Think anti-Semitism was bad on TikTok? Wait till you see Red Note.
Yeah. Okay. All right, dude. Relax, Tablet. Nobody cares.
Yeah. So.
Yeah. They're still using, like, I think, these sort of like gatekeeping tactics that like nobody gives a shit about anymore.
Oh yeah,
it's not that people are either pro-Semitic or anti-Semitic. It's like that is meaningless in context to what's actually happening.
Well, they rendered it meaningless because it's like, you know, what is it? They rendered it meaningless. It's like criticism of Israel, that's anti-Semitic. Elon doing, you know, that little fucking stunt of his in the inauguration. Oh, that's totally okay.
Yeah, the Sig Heil from nowhere.
Yeah,
yeah.
That's not anti-Semitic at all.
Yeah. We trust him. He's good to Israel.
But like criticizing Israel, like saying, hey, maybe you shouldn't do human rights abuses or like torture prisoners and, you know, doing horrible things to Palestinians. No, that's anti-Semitic. You can't talk about that right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, you know, and I think that there was the part that was really surprising to me. Not surprising, but it's still a thing where when I see it, I'm kind of shocked because it's still kind of like a whoa moment for me because there was so much, especially for me, and I'm sure as you, as Chinese people watching just the incredible sheer volume of like Sinophobic like ideology and propaganda being laid in every like every nook and cranny, every single article, even if it really wasn't related to China, mm-hmm. would frame it in Sinophobic, you know, new Cold War terms. And for years I've been seeing this. I mean, this predated COVID. I mean, that, oh, yeah. You know,
it predated COVID. I really picked it up during, mm-hmm. what was it? During the trade wars, like in 2008.
During the trade wars, yeah.
Yeah. That was like when it went off and I was like, oh, this sounds.
What the hell's going on here? Yeah.
Yeah.
And then suddenly, you know, you see the Xiao Hongshu jailbreak and you have people literally saying stuff like, you know, if this is what you're telling me, Chinese communism is, if this is what's evil, then I prefer this. There was a guy, a white dude.
I sent you, I don't know if I was the one, I sent you like, you remember it was like this white kid is like, oh my God, I was so afraid. We had to fight the Chinese to like the death. I was deadly afraid of you guys. And then I go on Red Note and I see all this stuff. Like, if you guys come and conquer, like, yeah, we don't get certain rights. I'm okay with it. Like, your living standard is good. I'm okay with this.
Like, I mean, I think those are tongue-in-cheek statements, but I think that they're...
But, like, there's a tone of seriousness.
Yes, and there's a sort of, like, don't tell me this is... I don't care.
Yeah.
Your Sinophobic shit, I see through it. It's bullshit. That's what those statements to me mean.
And I saw... The other thing is, like, I'm seeing, like, teenage girls. I'm seeing, like, old-age Karens. Like, people that you would assume would say... Not because they're actually xenophobic, but they would say anti-racist, anti-Asian stuff. Like, you know, off the cuff, right? Like, you know, ching chong, like all that shit. And they're actually saying, like, ni hao, and then genuinely trying to make an effort to, you know, like, learn Chinese.
Yeah, it's incredible. I saw, there was on I think it's some podcast, I just saw it on YouTube, a little bit of it. And it's Will Meneker, the guy from Chapo.
Yeah.
And the, you know how like in the beginning they'll have like a, you know, highlight, they'll just have a few highlights of the coming pod.
Yeah.
There's a part in there where they're talking about how did the Democrats fuck up this election so bad, where Will Meneker looks in the camera and he's like, and you know what? To President Xi, if you're hearing this, I'm all on board. If you want to come over here and run this shit for us, put me in the game, sir. Meaning, I think like it's such a change because a guy like him, on, you know, these sort of like American leftists, on, you know, people on the left, they would always sort of caveat China. Like whenever that topic came up, they would always sort of caveat like, as horrible or authoritarian as China is, you know, whatever. Like they would always throw that in to say, I'm not going so far as to approve of China.
Yeah.
But now they're just like, no, fuck it. You know what? This is so fucked up that, yeah, fuck it. I would prefer to have Xi Jinping run this place than you motherfuckers. You know? Yeah.
Although, unfortunately for him, like, you know, as I said to the, you know, in a very serious tone, I will say this for our listeners, if they're unacquainted, China has 1.4 billion people. I don't think the Chinese have any interest whatsoever.
No, of course not.
More people. This is also why...
But that's not his point, right?
I know.
His point is like, what I'm saying is like, they're no longer feeling meaning I think a lot of Americans.
They no longer need to feel the justification like, okay, China does something right, even though it's bad. It's just like straight up like, hey, maybe we should emulate something that China has.
There's no longer this ideological assumption that China is worse and that's a no-go. Like, we can't talk about China in any positive way. You know, they're all, and I think they start. It's really, truly seems to be a mass awakening to the idea that Sinophobia was a bullshit cover to justify
Look, Teen, I think you are absolutely right. You remember when you said to me that people imbibe this shit, but they know it's bullshit. And the example and evidence you gave me was the protest with the embassies. Israel and China's embassies, the PRC embassies, are right next to each other.
Correct. Which ones right next to each other. It's incredible.
Which one gets organic protest, not like the CIA-funded Falun Gongs or the fucking NED-funded like Aurora Chans or whatever.
Where like 12 people show up and they're all insane.
Yeah. It's like it's the Israelis. Average Americans protest the Israelis. They couldn't give two shits about the Chinese.
Yeah. Dude, nobody burned themselves alive in front of the Chinese embassy like they did in front of the Israeli embassy, okay?
Yeah.
Like, so, like it's not even fucking close. Right, so
I think you were right, and you know, I was wrong on this. I think you were right. I think you are right in the sense that Americans, you know, this seems like it was the push to, for most Americans to say, oh, this is kind of bullshit and this is kind of dumb. And the other part of me that is really happy is, you know, sharing, right? I think Americans are finally able to see like China the way that we see it. If you know what I mean.
Yeah.
Not like this horrid authoritarian place or all that, but like the friendly people, the rich culture,
the creative,
like you know, even before this, I don't know if you watch these videos. I would occasionally watch on Facebook, like, you know, Chinese chefs making things or, you know, Chinese influencers make, you know, in the countryside doing things. And it was wonderful for me to watch. And it's like, you know,
I saw an incredible one yesterday of a Chinese cowboy guy, and not like you know funny cowboy. No, like a legit fucking dude, like older dude living out in Inner Mongolia with a ranch.
Oh shit! Damn.
And he has horses and all this stuff. And he was like, this is for you Americans. He was like, I love American cowboy culture. He was like, I'm a cowboy. He was like, I live in Inner Mongolia. And he was like, this is my ranch. And he was like, a lot of people in China love the show Yellowstone.
Yeah.
And he was like, I used to be a director. I lived in Beijing for 30 years and then I moved out here. And then he was just sort of showing his lifestyle, living in yurts and stuff. And and then reading off all the comments that people were leaving. Because I guess he got a lot of he racked up tens of thousands of followers, mostly American.
Yeah.
And then he was reading off like all these comments because it gets translated to his like Mongolian friend. And he was just like, yeah, they're into this shit. They love it. Like this dude from Texas, this dude from Kansas, this girl from Idaho. And this girl from Idaho is like, you know, I'm going to start learning Chinese. This is cool. You know, like it's amazing.
Yeah.
It's amazing. And this is exactly in a way I think this is terrifying in a way. This is deeply, this kind of thing, in my opinion, is truly upsetting for the what I would consider an imperial leadership.
Oh yeah,
I think we have an imperial leadership. Like I don't think Trump is bothered by this. I don't think he's an imperial. I think he's a nationalist leader. But I think we have an imperial.
Well, I think the imperial leadership would be bothered by this in the sense that this really disturbs the imperial mission, right? Like America is the land of the free. It's the best place to be. And there is no other alternatives. And then now you're seeing in China, wait, there's an alternative. We don't have to live like the way that we do. And what do you mean? Like, you know, what do you mean? Like there's a better way to do it. Like, what do you mean? Wait, like you guys don't have to pay property taxes.
Yeah.
You know, these people are asking, like, wait, living. It's like, wait, groceries are actually cheap and affordable? Stuff like that. So, yeah.
I think they're seeing, like, wait, what is all these? Where are the values, like, that you're telling me that I can only get in the West? Like, I'm looking at these people. I'm interacting with them directly. We're leaving comments to each other. What is missing? How do I see and feel the lack of freedom and democracy? You know, I don't, right? Like, they're like, I don't sense it. I don't sense the urgency of this. Like, I think what Mearsheimer called the liberal hegemony, the project of liberal hegemony, pretty much sums up, I think, what this whole thing is. It's a sort of like world unifying, world encompassing political project that's based on really soft notions and abstract notions of values that people are starting to realize. It's like you lay it on really thick because it doesn't really mean anything. Like there's no there's no real substance to anything that you're saying about this. And I don't think any of us should really care about it.
Or in the sense that it's become so abstracted.
Abstract.
It's like a catechism. Yeah, it's like a catechism. It's like, you know, a mantra, a chant, right? Like, there's no material basis for this stuff. You talk about dignity and decency, but, well, the Chinese are living in dignity. Yes, they don't have certain, you know, rights. They don't vote for, like, who the lead president is. And, yes, there's censorship. You can't mention CCP, not CCP. You can't mention Xi Jinping, even, you know, positively. That'll get you censored. But it's like, we censor ourselves, too. At least the Chinese are explicit and very clear about what they censor, right?
Yeah.
I once wrote on Twitter when someone said, wow, Pompeo lost all that weight. And I said, oh, I hope it's colon cancer. And then I got censored for it.
Yeah.
You know, and it's not clear what can get censored and what can't.
Yeah.
What doesn't. The Chinese are very explicitly clear. No mention of Xi Jinping, even if it's positive. You mention him, censored.
Yeah.
And what do you mean, like, dignity? The Chinese seem to be living in dignity. They seem to have affordable stuff. They seem to, you know, they own their homes, the majority of them. I mean, it's not the best, but they seem to have good public amenities. We don't have any of this stuff. You know, Americans are looking at themselves. We don't have any of this stuff. Why the hell not? We were told we were the best. So this, I think you're right in the sense that it is a huge blow to the American imperial project and the perception of prestige that is associated with the imperial project. And perhaps it could even get Americans to question, you know, the actual cost of empire.
Yeah.
So that's, but yeah, it's a great development. I'm, and I already said this, but I'm very happy that Americans now get to see China in the way that I see it. You know, it's a beautiful country. And even when China wasn't that rich, you know, you went back in 2003, you know, people were hustling and they were busy, but you know, people were decent, they were kind, and they shared their time, you know, not just with families, but even strangers, right? Like, it was...
Yeah, though I would say it was a rougher place.
It was a rougher place. As I said, everyone was hustling. But it was still, like, you know, it's got that energy and whatnot. So...
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think... Here, let me pause it. So this is what I wanted to talk to you about.
Yeah.
Because... Now... I started thinking, okay, to long story short, I'm starting to see us having a USSR moment. And I'll explain what that means. When I say that, I think people immediately start getting ideas about it and trying to poke holes in this point. But I just want to lay it out.
Okay.
All right.
By the way, I don't disagree with you on the USSR moment. I think there are aspects of the American political system and the American society that is very, very much reminiscent of the USSR. But
yeah. Yeah. But I think it's a limited, you know, it's a limited comparison. I'm not saying that we can learn everything about what's going to happen from that. Mm-hmm. But I think that there are some notable parallels, right?
Oh, yeah.
And I first started thinking about this when I came across Adam Curtis's hypernormalization, you know, that doc on, I don't know if you ever watched it. I never watched the whole thing. I more kind of heard people talking about it, and I heard some interviews that he gave about it. And he said, so hypernormalization was a term that a Soviet dissident, maybe not a dissident, but a Soviet commentator who was very critical of the Communist Party and the Socialist Project at that late stage, sort of in the mid to late 80s, said that hypernormalization was this feeling where everyone in the Soviet Union knew nothing was working. Everyone knew everything was absurd. Everyone knew it was falling apart, but nobody said anything about it. Nobody did anything about it because there was no alternative. There was nothing else to do. It wasn't like there was some other, you know, there was some other thing that you could vote for or work for or anything. It was just, you know, just days carried on, even as things got more and more intensely dysfunctional. And he called that hyper-normalization in the sense that all sorts of bizarre, crazy events became normal because there was no other choice. And he said he felt that what was happening in the Western world, particularly in the United States and in Great Britain. And that started making me sort of like more attentive to this idea. And lately, I think the Xiaohongshu thing kind of really triggered this sense like, man, we may be on the inside here. Like, mm-hmm. to the extent that the Soviets found themselves sort of like painted into a corner by their own sort of self-imposed segregation and isolation from the world, thinking that they were actually, but still nominally committed to this idea that they were going to spread socialism to the rest of the world. Mm-hmm. They were really the center of the world. They were sort of the outside, and they were going to liberate everyone else. Like, they ended up realizing that they were the inside, and they are the ones who wanted to break through that wall. And I think that's kind of what Xiaohongshu made me see first, just at that cultural level, which is I'm starting to see that Americans view this whatever liberal project, and I think we're still struggling to put terms and definitions around it, but we're getting there, that what Mearsheimer refers to as the liberal project of liberal hegemony seems to be in some ways parallel, not in its ideological substance, but in sort of like its abstraction, its sort of meaninglessness, and the absurd results that it produces, mm-hmm. as I think Eastern European socialism was becoming in the 1980s. Mm-hmm. And while it remained a powerful project and an organizing principle from up top, below, like, nobody really believed in it. It was widely accepted, but nobody really felt for it deeply. And it was threatening to see people just sort of naturally turn away from it. Like, this is bullshit. You know, like, anyway, that's sort of my broad view of it. If that makes sense to you.
Yeah. So, I mean, the notion of hyper, it's basically that the ideology of socialism has lost, you could say, either its luster, its fervor, but people just go along with it because there is, quote unquote, no alternative within the mm-hmm. Soviet sphere. Mm. And it produced, basically, you could say, like, what is it? A malaise of sorts. In basically the Soviet bloc, that's essentially, you know, I'm guessing what hypernormalization, what they're talking about, right? Mm-hmm. Like, in the sense, no one know what they can do, and everyone just goes along with it, like the emperor has no clothes. In a way, is that a good summary?
Yeah, I mean that's I think what Adam Curtis was saying about the conditions within the West itself. Mm-hmm. And I feel like Xiaohongshu breakout, that, you know, this TikTok refugee thing, is a demonstration of that, right? It's a demonstration to say, if we are like culturally and politically in a place similar to where, let's say, the Eastern Bloc was, mm-hmm. in the mid to late 1980s, as the wheels are really coming off the Soviet economy and the socialist project as a whole, that to see Americans so quickly enthusiastically embrace China, which is our sort of the sworn enemy.
Yeah. Mortal enemy.
You know, to me, I felt like that was more, it's really less about, here's the thing. I think it's really less about there is genuine interest in China, I'm sure. Just like there was genuine fascination with the West, but it is also very much a product, and perhaps even more so a product of disillusionment with the Western project, you know, with America, with Europe, or all parts of this.
Or the promises of the American dream, you could say, because if the American dream actually delivered, I don't think Americans would basically flock to Xiaohongshu and then be surprised and learn about, you know, all these differences, right? I don't think, you know, people found Japan fascinating in the 80s and 90s, but there wasn't a notion that, oh, you know, wow, they're like, I don't know, I was very young. Maybe you actually grew up, so maybe you could tell me. There wasn't the same reaction as Xiaohongshu when people learned about what Japan was like in the 90s, right? Or even 80s.
No, I don't think so. I think there was a fear of a sort of motivating fear, mm-hmm. and a sense of like, there, I mean, look, America in the 1970s and 80s, like, there were definitely very unpretty aspects to those era. I mean, the 70s was pretty shit. I mean, yeah. from a material perspective, 70s is probably marks a much lower point than we are at now.
You think so?
I do, because I think we didn't have like sort of like the, we had not really transitioned to sort of like the financial services economy that we are now.
Sorry to cut you off.
Yeah.
I guess for me, that wasn't the case because, you know, people still had the huge amount of savings that they did from, like, you know, the 1960s and 50s and then the golden age of capitalism. And there was still a decent, robust, relatively robust welfare state that wasn't yet dismantled by Reaganism. So I felt like, you know, maybe people were a lot, at least this is from my reading of history.
I think there was widespread malaise in terms of bombed out cities, social unrest, stagflation, right? There was massive inflation beyond anything we've experienced now. Mm-hmm. And a horrible, horrible fucking economic performance. This is prior to Reagan, mm-hmm. and in the early days of Reagan, before we really shifted into the neoliberal phase. And I think,
but Americans at then still had a lot of savings, and they still, it seems like, they had a lot more better material basis to meet that challenge. I mean, inflation was bad, but everyone was, you know, the job, you know, everyone, most people still had jobs, and the jobs paid like decent enough that, you know, you could put food on the table. And there wasn't,
I would agree with you, though. I would put it to say, and I heard this same discussion being had about the UK in around the same time.
Yeah.
Where it was an older guy. I forgot who was talking. But they were saying in the 1970s, although things actually on the ground looked worse than they do now, mm-hmm. there was still a sense that renewal was around the corner. Like, mm-hmm. the Reagan Thatcherites painted a picture of, like, you know, sort of mourning in America.
Yeah.
And people genuinely believed it, and there was, I feel like a very strong spectrum of leadership, including on the economic side, mm-hmm. like with a Milton Friedman type,
yeah,
that was putting real bones onto this sort of like national project of renovation, mm-hmm. and people bought into it. They were like, apparently these guys sound pretty fucking confident that this is going to work. And so everyone bought into this idea of a renewal project. And it did happen. It happened, right? Like the 80s became, you know, a very different time than the 70s.
And a dynamic time, yes.
Yeah.
I mean, income became stagnant for most people, but there was recovery. Inflation did get under control.
Yeah. Standard of living went up. You know.
Yeah.
Anyway, that was a time, I think, where we were sort of really like racing ahead in the Cold War. Mm-hmm. And it sort of ended in total victory, so to speak, for the West. We couch it as the United States versus the Soviet Union, but like, really, it was a sort of like Western order of alliances. It wasn't just NATO. It was also the EC, or now the EU, mm-hmm. the United States, a whole... Didn't they call that the First World?
Yeah. So the First World is the capitalist world against the Second World, which is the communist world. And then the Third World is the non-aligned world.
The non-aligned world, right?
So it's basically the First World. You could say the capitalist system, led by the United States, versus the socialist bloc, and the socialist system led by the Soviet Union. So yeah. You could say it was a triumph of, let's say, capital. When capital readjusted, instead of basically, you could say, the Keynesian, the Fordist mode of production, the national capital of, factory building, the 1980s readjusted and you had basically financialization, international capital, banking coming into the fore. And they really, drove this era back, push the dynamism back into the economy. Very uneven and unequal growth, but they pushed it back and they were the one that managed at least not to defeat the Soviets, but at least oversaw the conclusion of the Cold War, you could say. I would usually caution, just like as a brief aside, I would usually caution saying that it wasn't so much the United States defeated the Soviets as the Soviets kind of realized the high cost. And maybe this gets to your point about the similarities between the Soviet Union and the United States today. The Soviets voluntarily dismantled the system that they've established, the Warsaw Pact, and then voluntarily pulled back their military basically posture in Western Europe. And you're beginning, and there was a question about, well, do we want to continue the Cold War? And I think you were talking about this somewhere else, that you're sort of seeing a similar conversation, at least in the United States, about basically America's position in the world.
I believe so. I believe my belief, I don't know. I mean, it's going to take time to see,
it's going to take time. There are certainly evidence of this. I mean, Trump is not enthusiastic about NATO. He definitely
I think a lot of Trump's, okay, this is my point. I think Trump's worldview is in many ways an inverse image of Gorbachev's view, which is they're still fundamentally seeing the same thing, but from very different from different perspectives.
Okay.
Right? So he's not Gorbachev, because Gorbachev was he was like a neo-Leninist, right? I mean,
he was trying to save the socialist system within the USSR. Even though he ended up destroying it, he was genuinely trying to save it.
He was coming from a very, very different starting point in terms of his belief system let's put it this way, a completely inverted ideological perspective versus Donald Trump.
Mm-hmm.
But yet at the same time, I feel like there's a set of, and I'm reading more about Gorbachev's era, but I feel like his desires for the sort of future development of the Soviet Union was very much in line with the sort of political program of Trump. Number one, which is to say openly and in a rather sort of like, I would say in a subtly radical way, to call out the prior ruling era, I guess in his case, Brezhnev era, he called it the Great Stagnation.
Yep.
And when I read about that, I was like, that's the thing that Trump did, especially in that first election that he won, that really caught people, like I would say the liberal
elites
off guard, that really offended them.
Yeah.
Was the way, I remember his inauguration speech, his first one, when he called out the sort of like burnt out husks of the Rust Belt, the cities of the Rust Belt, these burnt out shells of cities in the Rust Belt. And the next day, the New York Times, I remember reading, said it was shocking that a U.S. president would give such a grim and dark view of the United States. And they just simply couldn't accept it.
Yeah.
They could not accept that he was what he was saying. And I was like, when I was reading this about Gorbachev's sort of insult to the Brezhnev era as that of great stagnation. Let's face it, we produce crap compared to the West. I was like, damn, this is familiar. Mm-hmm. No? Doesn't that seem a little bit familiar? I don't know. I think that is coming.
Well, both Gorbachev and Donald Trump are attacking the orthodoxies of basically their predecessors, mm-hmm. you could say. Although you could say that Gorbachev, there is a precedence for him because Khrushchev sort of did the same thing with the Stalin era. And the Chinese basically saw it as, you know, this is an aside for people that are curious. The Chinese view is this was a huge mistake. But so there was precedence for that. And I think
for them to call out for Khrushchev to have called out Stalin's crimes.
Yeah. And then for Gorbachev to call out the stagnation that you saw in Brezhnev. So I think you're seeing a parallel in that sense.
Yeah.
I would usually describe why the Soviets, America's like the Soviet Union. I usually look at it from a political economy standpoint, although the hypernormalization is a very interesting point, and I haven't thought of it that way, but it does make sense. I usually thought of it was basically from a political economy standpoint, which is that the Soviet Union knew that it produced crap, and that part of the reason why was because it was shielded, or, you know, it was basically cut off from the global market. So there was no basically market mechanisms and competitions to instill, at least them, to create within the Soviet economy competitive consumer products and why they're being left behind. And I think one thing, just on a brief aside, side note that's important to highlight. In fact, the only aspect of the Soviet economy, you know, this is actually counter to the conventional wisdom, that was competitive with the West was their military. Yes, they spent 14%, but it was not actually the part of the economy that was the biggest burden to the Soviet economy. It wasn't the military. This is actually counter to the conventional wisdom. It was the rest of the Soviet economy, which was not tied to some market mechanism or competition, and it was not tied to basically the global market, that it becomes that it's stagnant and uncompetitive.
There was another thing I came across in reading about this.
Let me finish this point just briefly. Yeah. And the part that's the parallel is you're seeing the same thing that is happening to the Americans, which is they are cutting except in the Soviet case, they're desperately trying to get back into pushing themselves back in being trying to integrate into the global economy. The U.S. is pushing away from the global economy and they're losing competitiveness. So the EVs, as an example, now you're seeing it in chips. You're seeing in a lot of consumer products where they're pushing back, purposely pushing back away. And then you're seeing American industry actually now being more and more and more uncompetitive, like the Soviets.
I know there's a lot of talk about the terrorists, but I think we need to see how this plays out. Because I don't necessarily think that the strategy here is isolationism. I think that he's put together an economic team that's actually pretty sharp. I think Besant knows that that's not the way. He's not a dumb guy, right? But I would say there was another aspect to that I was picking up on in terms of how Gorbachev viewed the situation back then.
Yeah,
which was that the Eastern Bloc. So countries outside of the Soviet Union, but still behind the Iron Curtain and part of the Warsaw Pact, those nations, he started to see them as sort of
a drain,
burdens that were becoming uncompetitive simply because he felt they were living off of the subsidy of the Soviet Union. Mm-hmm. And he wanted to cut them off. And I think that was one of the reasons he wanted to pull the troops out, was not simply as a show of good faith and maybe perhaps rolling over and showing belly to the Westerners, but also to tell the sort of perimeter of the Soviet Empire to say, hey, you're not living off the hog, high off the hog anymore. Yeah. Like, we're bringing back, you know, our capital and our people, and we're focusing on the reform of the Soviet Union itself. And I feel like with Trump, there's a similar sense now, and we're seeing this among our Western, among our European allies and Canada too, is this sort of like sudden turn on them. There's a hostility towards those who should be under our tent. And I think that really offends the liberals too. But they said, like, for example, today, I saw two things just today that I thought were remarkable. One was that Denmark finally had a call with Trump, and they were, quote, totally freaked out because they realized the guy's not fucking kidding around. He actually is going to take Greenland. He's serious about this, and they don't know what to do. And then the second was the Dutch, the Netherlands, have announced that they're going to completely ignore U.S. pressure to stop ASML sales of these lithography machines to China, which may sound like a small thing. It is. I don't think it's a big thing, but we made it to be a big thing. We said this is crucial, that in order to preserve the this project of Western dominance in semiconductors, none of you may do business with China, and you will feel the wrath if you do. And then the Netherlands says, "Ah, fuck you. We can't not sell to China. Come on, fuck you." ASML's profits still matter to us.
I think maybe they're trying to extract concessions from Trump. I think that's what the ASML case.
Maybe, but the point is that they're no longer interested in, they're no longer enthusiastically supporting a project of containing China. They are putting their own national interest.
Well, the Europeans, to be fair, the Europeans were never European industry was never enthusiastic about containing China.
No, but here's the thing. European leadership remains
the political leadership. Yes.
Yeah. So I think what's going on is that, okay, here's what I'm thinking, dude. All right. Let me just put this out here for you. I know it's going to be you don't like wonky talk. You like this sort of like disciplined academic talk, but there's no fucking United States, dude. It doesn't exist. There's no such thing. And that's what people are picking up on. There's no United States. Our leaders do not lead the United States. They are not even sovereign leaders. They're part of a supranational order that is, if from my perspective,
you could say,
is part of
capital.
It's part of these groups, these forums, the G7, NATO, EU, AUKUS,
the Quad. Cut you off and then just interject quickly. Sorry.
The IMF. Yeah, go ahead.
You could say international capital, and then we could talk about organizations like Bilderberg, the Trilateral Commission, basically all the institutions that facilitate American finance. You could say all the global.
It's not just American finance. It's a system that goes beyond the United States. United States is a critical component of it. Just as the Russian Federation is a critical component of the Soviet Empire, right? But I think that the thing that I don't agree with is this idea that the U.S. is an imperial power, and the Europeans, for example, are simply vassals. Japan's a vassal. No, they're not. None of these nations exist. You can't be a vassal if you don't exist.
You know, if you're curious, I hope you'll forgive me. If you're curious, there's a he was basically one of the people I studied, took a few classes with during my PhD. Very fascinating man. His name is Stephen Gill, and he actually wrote about the way that he sees it. He sees the U.S. as basically not so much the U.S. leading as a faction within capital, international finance.
Correct. Basically, this is the international. This is the Ned Beatty speech.
Yeah.
There is no countries. There's no United States. There's no races. There's no ethnicity. I mean, I think his speech was a little overblown, right? But I think the basic idea of that speech is real. You normal people think that there's a United States. You normal people think that there's countries and races and people. And he was like, there isn't. There's only one giant international order of money, of currency. Now, that's not my point of view. I think it's similar to that. It's, you know, but that's good for theatrics. But I would say there is a definite truth to the fact that I think that there simply isn't a United States with a unified national interest, it has become subsumed into an international order. We are not necessarily the leader of that order. We are a large and important component of it. But this idea that the United States is this world dominant superpower with vassals around it, which I think is a common perspective, is wrong. Each of those countries too has the same, they have governments that are similar to what you've described, that in those governments, which have these appallingly shit approval numbers, the second they get into office, Keir Starmer becomes what? The least popular. I mean, every single PM that gets in office anywhere in Europe immediately becomes the least popular head of state in history.
Gil calls this the new constitution. So it's not they're serving their national constituents as much as they're serving international capital. And this is why you see the echo of no matter who goes in, whether it's Maloney, whether it's Starmer, whether it's fucking Joe Biden, that they have the same fucking script. And it's the same neoliberal policies.
Yeah, they're all the same people.
Same imperial overreach. It's basically an international club in the sense, basically, these are people that are picked, you could say, from the litter that's discussed in the Bilderberg group, right?
I think it's best to describe it not as international, but as supranational. Meaning, it's no longer the United States showing up to the table in conjunction with Germany. No. These people do not see countries. They don't see borders. They don't operate with borders in mind. And I got the taste of this when I was working in government. And when we were building, so my job at the government was to implement the Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform Act, right? We were going to take that act and turn it into operative rules at the regulatory level for the federal, for the SEC. I had counterparts at the Department of Treasury, at the Federal Reserve, Office of the Comptroller, things like that, right?
But basically, you're standardizing it for your American specific department, what the Dodd-Frank Act.
Our American, for us, it was the securities regulation, right? Okay, so how did that go about? All of the SES level, meaning like the very senior staff, suddenly got passports and all of them started going to Brussels. And all of our rulemaking was actually taking place in Brussels. Brussels is where we coordinated rulemaking with the ECB and, you know, all the national regulators and the FCA from, or FSA from, the UK, everyone was meeting there. And then all our rules looked identical to each other. And our rules had to be substantively equal. And in fact, if a French bank came to the United States, we would give it a sort of regulatory visa to say, we will deem you to be in compliance with the US rules if your home regulator certifies to us that you're in compliance with rules in Paris. Right? And then Brexit happened, right? They voted for Brexit. The people of Britain, of the UK, rose up and said, no longer will we be controlled by
Brussels.
Brussels, right? Okay, so what did they do? I'm not fucking kidding. I'm not exaggerating. They literally took all of the financial rules coming out of the, it was called EMIR. EMIR is the set of the European Commission's rules that were equivalent to Dodd-Frank. So we had Dodd-Frank, Europe had EMIR. Now, the UK was part of EMIR. Now suddenly they're not part of EMIR. You know what they did? They literally control C, control F. They copy and pasted EMIR and replaced European Union or whatever with United Kingdom. I'm not exaggerating. The rules are word for word verbatim. They took all of the European regulations and they simply, now that they're, quote, free of the EU, they just word replaced European Union with the United Kingdom. And so it was the same rules. No one had to do. So it's like even if your people vote to break apart from this international order, you still don't break apart because substantively speaking, that ruling faction, that cadre that represents capital, as you put it, just import the rules of the game.
Yeah, it's a new
and
constitution.
Put them in place. There's no difference.
I think he called it the new constitution, in the sense you got to impose the same set of neoliberal ruling principles as all the others in order to enjoy the benefits and access into basically this global capital elite. So basically it puts a pressure to harmonize all of these countries, no matter where the starting point social welfare standings are, and then basically, you know, harmonize all of them.
I can tell you as a former bureaucratic grunt that is exactly how it works.
I don't fully agree with his view, but I think you would really love, I'll send it to you afterwards, but Stephen Gill, that's his name, G-I-L-L, and he wrote a lot about this, and he was at York University, but he wrote basically a lot about international capital and international finance.
If you look at banks, if you look at global banks, you've got Deutsche Bank, BNP Paribas, Barclays, you know, all the big European banks compared to JP Morgan, Goldman Sachs, all the big American banks, right? They're all the same fucking thing, dude. They're the same. They operate under the same rules. They are structurally identical to each other. They all do the same thing. Okay. And there's no line, even down to the base regulations, the level at which I work in, there's no difference. They're the same thing. They're the same entity. And you can't say that BNP is headquartered in London and Goldman Sachs is headquartered in New York. There's an address. Their people are everywhere. Goldman Sachs is just as much based in Europe as BNP is based in New York. So from the financial side of this, which I think is the most directly connected to this capital, this notion of international capital, it's 100% true, dude. There's no difference. I think the main difference between us and the Soviet Union, in the sense that I do believe, like, us and especially our European counterparts, but the same is true of Japan, and the same is also true of Hong Kong as financial centers. Okay, Canada and Australia pretty much come along for the ride too. We don't really much care about them. We know they'll copy us, so we don't have to force them to. But they'll just come along.
They're and peripheral. There's like 30 million people, and most of Canada's financing. What does Canada do? It's basically mineral extractions, and we get most of our financing. Like any great things, the financing is in New York. The TSX, the Toronto Stock Exchange. That's mostly just Canadian mineral companies.
We're
basically subcontracted imperialists. Basically we got our own turf, but it's only really mineral extractions.
And now we're thinking about just bringing you in, like, full merger. dude, I'm telling you, like, it is a union. This is a supranational union, and it is written in the laws. Now, it doesn't have a constitution per se. It doesn't have a founding date. It doesn't have, but it certainly has bylaws. It has a lot of fucking, it has office spaces.
You could say the date is, when was the Trilateral Commission? In the 70s, late 70s, early 80s. You could say the date was then, because you had the crisis of American hegemony with Nixon, with, the Vietnam War, right? And in a way, this is a transition away from national capital. Nixon unpegging the dollar from gold, and then basically bringing in the supremacy of finance.
I agree. What I'm saying is that we never announced the formation of this union.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
In the way that the Soviet Union said, this is the date, that, you know, 1918, this is the date of, you're right. So what I'm saying
sorry about that.
Oh, no, no, no. What I'm saying is that the main difference, I think, is that we're more clever than the Soviets, because, like, we're sort of ideologically inverted. And whereas I think they become in the extreme under their ideological orientation, really sort of like heartfelt true believers. Like Gorbachev was like a poetic man, you know what I mean? Like he apparently really liked to surround himself with writers and poets and stuff. You know, he really felt it in his heart.
He was a very sensitive soul. I mean,
sensitive soul. I cannot dislike the man the more I learn about him.
Well, I would say this. Can I just a brief interruption? Yeah, I don't like him as look, out of all the political leaders I've read about, I think Gorbachev is probably one of the only people I would actually want as a friend.
Yeah, true. But yeah,
I would never want him to run a fucking country.
I would never. You know what? Good friend, terrible boss. Don't you think? He sounds like a terrible boss.
Yeah,
he drove a lot of people crazy.
I don't know. He would be cool to hang out with. Terrible boss.
Yeah,
but I would never want him to run my fucking country. I would want him to be a friend, but not to run my country. I would want someone else to run my country.
But so I think that their ideological orientation, the Soviet sort of Marxist-Leninist orientation, in the extreme leads to these sort of like that personality, whereas ours leads to Anthony Blinken. You know, it leads to soulless sort of like these soulless automatons that don't believe in anything, nihilists. Okay. The difference between them is they want to put a name on everything. They're proud of what they're doing. Uh-huh. So they put a name on it. They called it that. They put borders on it. You know, We are more clever. I think we never put a name on it. Our empire has a million different fucking names. One day it's the G7. One day it's the fucking, I don't know, name whatever you want.
It's more Marcus. Informal.
Yeah. It's informal. It's both.
The empire is both informal and the pressure it exerts is not explicit. It's not like the Soviet Union that there's an army. The pressure that exerts is very great. It's the market forces and the pressures.
No, you guys, see, this is where you guys are wrong.
Yeah.
That's not true. It is very formal. The difference, I think it's formal, but it's multimodal. So not any one name captures all of it, but it does have many names. And I think that you could easily call G7 one of its forms, one of its modes, just like NATO is one of its modes. G7 is sort of a quasi-economic mode, but NATO is a military mode. EU is a large sort of like subsidiary mode. You know what I mean?
Yeah, but you have was it Bilderberg Group?
Yeah.
And then have Davos. You have all of these different functions.
But all of these, but the more formal versions of these, including the IMF, are absolutely formal in the sense that they have enforceable bylaws. They have enforceable regulations. They operate with the force of law.
Can I ask you a question? Since you actually worked for the FCC, right?
SEC. I worked. Yes.
So the question then is: you talked about basically you got to harmonize with Europe, but the origin of the laws and the rules, they still came from America. It's not like Europe was like, you know, the origin of this stuff, right? I mean, it was America that came up with this.
No, it was a negotiation.
But it's like America was the one that was like behind the driver's seat, right? Like in a car.
No, it wasn't.
You would
have a driver
and then you would negotiate.
It's not.
It wasn't?
No, wrong. It's coming from the banks.
Okay.
The entire legislation here, let me explain to you what it looks like to write a rule that that covers the, let's say, the how we weight risk assets when it comes to a large financial institution, which means how much capital do these people, do the investors have to put into the bank? Okay, what does it look like to write such a rule? The chief risk officer of a large bank, let's say Goldman Sachs, which is an example, he'll take the Acela down in the morning. We will know he arrived. My boss will have collected pocket money from all of us as individuals because we're not allowed to pay for anything. We will actually buy a spread of sandwiches and stuff for this guy. We get in a meeting room, a conference room. And, you know, there's a lot of like sort of backslapping and a little bit of a friendly banter.
Yeah.
And then he gets very serious and says, okay, so these are our concerns. Mm-hmm. And we listen very intently. And my job is to take every fucking thing that he says and writes it down. Mm-hmm. And then I have to summarize it in a memo to file afterwards. And all of that stuff 100% has to find its way in some respect into the rule that we write,
into the legislation.
Yeah.
But you're
so he came down from New York for the day on the Acela. We sat there, like I sat there as a very loyal and dilettante scribe.
Yeah.
And we made the rules that way. Mm-hmm. You know, and is he America? No, he's not. He's representative of the bank. Is that bank American? No, it's not. It's equally based in every financial capital of on the globe within this system. Tokyo, London, Paris, Frankfurt, New York,
but
San Francisco.
But can I ask? So, quick question. Can I ask?
Toronto,
but most of the banks that you take these notes for as a scribe, these are their predominant. Their primary center of operation is in the United States, right? Like you don't.
No, not necessarily.
You don't listen to what is it? Barclay, like
Barclay. That's not true. We absolutely listen to Barclays.
Okay, so you would listen to Deutsche Bank if they got
a concern. Of course, yes. Deutsche Bank, like,
or Credit Suisse, or so, and you would listen to them equally as much as Citi, or
no, you wouldn't, not necessarily, because it is true that the American money center banks, of course, are larger than their European counterparts here, or the Japanese have a large presence in New York too. Now, they don't necessarily have as much say with us, the American regulators, of course, as the American ones. That's your point. I agree. However, they do have loads of things to say to the European Commission. And they're much more, they have much more power with the European Commission than, say, Goldman Sachs does, even though Goldman Sachs operates in Europe. Right? So what happens is there's sort of a negotiation where it's like, okay, the EC is going to write certain rules that are going to affect our boys, and we are going to write rules that's going to affect their boys. So, you know what? We're going to have to get all the SES guys over to Brussels. And that's how it comes about, because we all realize that we're all operating within the same system. And we cannot unilaterally write rules in America. We have to take into account how it's going to work over there, because the system doesn't recognize borders. You're like, Goldman Sachs as a global operation cannot work if our rules in New York, in the United States, don't align with the rules in Paris or London.
They need They've all got to be harmonized.
They need to harmonize, because that money's coming across that border every day. Every minute, you've got money flowing in through each center. Right? So, I mean, it just doesn't compute that we would have different rules. The whole point is we have to have stable rules across the whole system.
Okay. Sorry,
and that's what I mean.
I hope I didn't mean to distract from what we want to talk about in the pod. This is just very fascinating to me.
It's fascinating to me too, because I'm talking about, as I'm talking about this.
Yeah,
it's like I'm thinking about it, right?
I ask a quick question? Sorry to interrupt, because like
actually, you know what?
Yeah,
you know what? This might be, it's an hour three. This might be a good point to transition to. You want to finish this in a bonus pod?
Yeah, sure.
All right.
But so before we go, like, if you want to,
yeah, set it up, queue it up. Yeah. We'll, yeah.
Did you talk about like this stuff? I would love to. I didn't remember looking at the catalog. Like, did you ever talk about this? I would love to listen to one of the pods if you talked about it in the past. Like, this is actually fascinating to me.
No, because I never really thought about it this way until recently.
No, because I would love if you do a separate pod about this stuff, because I've only read about this stuff in the abstract, if you know what I mean. Like, I've read about this stuff, like Stephen Gill, and I would love, if you want, I'll send you a book, and we could do even, like, a reading club. Just tell me, like, if this is, like, crazy or not, if this is exactly your experience. I was much more skeptical of this stuff, but, like, because I've never seen it in action, right? I've seen, like, as I said, that author, Stephen Gill, the way that he described it, and a lot of what he said really matched how he described it. But for me, that was more academic, right?
Right.
So this is actually very fascinating to me.
Yeah, yeah. No, we could go more into it, but we'll...
But it's like digressing from the pod, so like let's keep to the original. We could like do this at another pod, or we could do the organization, but it's like...
Well, no, I think it's the same topic. I don't think you've... Yeah. I don't actually think you've gone off topic. We've gone off topic with this. I think it's the same topic, but we can...
Yeah.
We'll... Well, okay, so we'll...
Well, you're the host, this. So you got to figure out, like, where are we going, and, you know, you got to lead. I'll follow.
It'll be a mystery. If you guys want to check out the second part of the pod, it'll be... and you're not already a supporter, go to patreon.com/planningmag if you want to support. And all the bonus episodes and stuff will be available to you there. All right.
And if you're not subscribing, you're missing out. Yeah. That's all I'm going to say.
All right.